Hello and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan and I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, it was a pretty interesting week in macro news. While El Salvador is not exactly someplace that comes up in market conversations often, this week it became the first nation to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender, and didn't exactly go very smoothly. Also, another major central bank made it clear it's ready to start tapering bond purchases that it's been making to counteract the effects of the pandemic now that the recovery is picking up steam. What does it all mean? We'll get into it with a macro strategist at an investment advisory firm. But first, Valdana, I have to ask, it's back to school week, which is means there's a lot of drama in the Regan household with, you know, getting your books in the backpack and having the right outfit and everything. I was trying to figure out what Valdana, a young Valdana, was like at back to school time. I'm guessing you were like gung-ho to get back to school every September.
Yeah, I loved back to school. It was so fun. All the new stuff, you know, all the, your new notebooks and things.
All the new grammar you would learn.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Don't get me excited.
I figured I should have had you give a pep talk to my daughters. I had a feeling you were enthusiastic back to school.
How was back to school for you when you were going to school in the 1880s?
Oh, in the 1880s. Oh, my God. Did you catch that zing? Jeez. It was, well, you know, it was a one-room schoolhouse, and we had to walk both ways uphill in the snow and that sort of thing. But, you know, 1880s. Boy, that hurt.
I'm sorry.
That hurts.
I'm dealing with this now too, Mike, right? I mean, I got a teenage son who's, you know, he's in 10th grade now. So dealing with all that stuff, same thing.
That voice there is Ben Emmons. That's our guest. He's a macro strategist at Medley Global Advisors. Ben, how's back to school going in your household?
Well, it's actually smooth. This is more my wife giving me a hard time, but I don't know. My son is actually following the instructions, so it's more than it's more the knuckle sandwich that gets served every day, you know.
But I wanted to talk to you about what I mentioned at the opening there, is El Salvador. I know you've been watching the El Salvador situation. Fascinating to me that we finally have Bitcoin as legal tender, albeit not in a major market or economy. But I think, you know, it's breaking that seal of a government actually accepting Bitcoin as legal tender. Walk us through sort of the implications of it in your view. I mean, is this a big deal in sort of the evolution of crypto, even though there was kind of a glitchy introduction in El Salvador? How are you thinking about it all? You know, what does this week mean sort of from the evolution of Bitcoin?
It's definitely an important step, Mike, because look, if you have a country as small as El Salvador is, and although it doesn't have a major currency and that currency is backed to the dollar, it's an economy adopting Bitcoin in a wider way, like as in everything that you want to buy and transact in can be done there in Bitcoin through that Chivo wallet that they created, where they purchased, I believe, something like $40 million of Bitcoin in there. And so obviously there's a limited amount, but okay, it's enough for people to get really comfortable with transacting in something that allows them to be part of this digital revolution and not dealing with a black market, right? Like some of these countries like El Salvador or Argentina and Venezuela will probably go this way too. Yeah, people transact more in the black market. And while they're having an official currency rate, that doesn't mean much. So I think the implication of it is that other central banks are taking this also serious. And what I noted was just not that long ago, I think just a week or 2 weeks before El Salvador, you know, launched this Bitcoin law, the Central Bank of Australia launched a project with the Central Bank of South Africa, Singapore, and I believe it was Korea, to look at the way of using a digital currency, central bank digital currency, CBDC, and allow it for international payments, so cross-border payments, really more the institutional version of Bitcoin. And so as that project gets underway, it's called Project Dunbar, and you have this El Salvador example, I think we're making a big leap forward here, or where we're ultimately going to be in, is that although our currency system will not change, because that would put an end to our conventional monetary policy as it is, right? You know, that will not happen. But the fact that you're going to transition to a digital world where you can settle everything digitally, you can transact everything digitally, can you then imagine that we can actually open the stock market during the weekend? That could be an implication. You know, that sounds big, but it is actually the way, because if you can instantly settle money and securities that fast because of the technology, well, yeah, that's a huge leap forward, right, for mankind, as a famous astronaut said.
Ben, Vildana just got very excited when you mentioned the stock market open on the weekends. That means she'll get to work on the weekends, which I think is a dream.
Well,
for
I do sometimes cover Bitcoin whenever it's really volatile. We do tend to cover it over the weekends as well. But yeah, my eyes did just, for all the listeners, sort of get really wide. But Ben, I do want to ask you, it used to be an argument that a lot of crypto people made about Bitcoin, that eventually you're going to start seeing it being used to purchase your morning coffee or your morning breakfast sandwich or whatever, which never really panned out, at least not in the US. It's really difficult to do something like that. Depending on how things play out in El Salvador, does that mean potentially that that could be an argument again for why somebody might want to own Bitcoin, where you might be able to use it to transact with your everyday needs?
Yeah, I think so, because if people get comfortable with this, with a cryptocurrency, which is volatile, and, you know, the argument was made when El Salvador launched this, that as Bitcoin sold off because of the glitch, that people say, okay, so I just bought a pizza that was worth, you know, 50,000 Bitcoin, dollars of Bitcoin, now it's worth 20,000, let's say. That's pretty strange, right? It would not be, very pleasant. But I think it's just like when you had in the past how the banking system was so traditional of just cash going around, that has become already digital. I mean, I do most of my payments through my iPhone or an app, most of it. So I think that is the direction we're heading with this. As you mentioned, there's a fair bit of regulatory oversight that's needed, and it's not clear who's going to be the responsible agency to look after crypto. That's, I think, the big issue in the United States. The SEC wants to regulate it, but then you have the IRS, and then you have the Treasury Department, then you have maybe the Department of Justice, and there's another agency. But I do think that we're not that far away from that reality to have crypto being used for payment, because last year in the summer, a bit quietly, but the Office of Currency Controller, which is the regulator for commercial banks, did allow banks to accept crypto as a quote-unquote deposit. And so if people had purchased crypto, they could actually deposit it at their bank. Now, I don't know the exact technical specifics of it, but that news item always was in my mind like, okay, so if we're starting with making it possible to be a deposit, then it becomes an anchor, right, for using it as a means of payment over time, even though it's still very subject to volatility in markets, subject to technological challenges and the concerns over the technological challenges in fraud and criminal activity that obviously here are big concerns about politically. They want to make sure that obviously doesn't happen. So, but I think El Salvador, as small of a country it is one, you know, one sort of step forward of this.
I find it fascinating that no regulators can sort of decide who's in charge of this thing. But I think they should put the Space Force in charge of it. You know, the goal is always to send these things to the moon. So put the Space Force in charge of regulating it. But Ben, I know you've been doing a lot of analysis, sort of looking at relationships between Bitcoin and Ethereum and crypto in general with the more traditional asset classes in the market, oil and stocks, meme stocks. I think, you know, you've noticed some kind of correlations and relationship. Walk us through what your analysis of that looks like. You know, how does Bitcoin sort of fit in to the traditional asset classes? Is it influencing the prices of, I mean, obviously you've got your stocks that are exposed to crypto in some way, but is it influencing things on a macro level in your opinion?
Well, you have to start with that last point that you're making. So, you know, the list of companies that have using Bitcoin or crypto or having a more digitalized business has just compounded as it's increased very rapidly. And, you know, that does influence the stock market, because if you take all those companies together as a market weight and there's direct or indirect exposure to crypto or Bitcoin, then the fluctuation of Bitcoin has become more correlated with the changes in the S&P 500. That's particularly this year has been the case. That's a big difference from the number of years before. Then obviously, as we had the more wider adoption, if not recognition, on institutional side, particularly people who manage money institutionally, looking at crypto as this must be another alternative, that plays a big role too. And that's where the regulatory parts of it come into play when it comes to the SEC and the Treasury Department. And then as you have this sort of correlation between Bitcoin and broader markets positive, right? It's been a positive correlation this year. You may think about then that you can take the steps further of, okay, this could affect different assets, not just equities, but it could spill over to other assets. Now, what's interesting with crypto and Ethereum, for example, too, it's obviously high energy usage, right? And one thing that has happened with Ethereum is it got back in significant demand because of the upgrade, London upgrade that happened a few weeks ago. And the fact that the non-fungible tokens have exploded in trading. So people are very excited about that, but you need Ethereum for that. Ethereum is, of course, related to the blockchain technology. Ethereum does require a fair bit of energy. And so Ethereum gas prices, as they say, which are you can find online, have jumped. So there's a bit of that relationship too of the physical markets with the space of crypto. So I think it all points to the same direction of, as we were talking in the previous discussion, was you have crypto assets that are becoming part of the investment universe. The transition from what it was like a very esoteric technology that was off exchange and very privately managed and traded becomes more wider adopted. And then what you're going to get now is crypto stocks, crypto bonds, crypto futures, which exist, Bitcoin futures. And as we move to that ETF, which is, I think, likely to happen at some point, yeah, you get the retail public even more involved, a different retail public than those meme traders that you talk about, which is the link. They've moved from meme stocks to non-fungible tokens recently for some reason. But, you know, the fact that you get then meme stocks, which like MicroStrategy is a company that's considered to be a meme stock. Yeah, that's all about Bitcoin, right? MicroStrategy. So there goes those linkages between meme stocks, non-fungible tokens, and Bitcoin, right? So I think it's just morphing into this larger and larger universe of the relationships between Bitcoin, crypto assets, and financial assets.
Ben, not to spend too much time on cryptocurrencies, although it is so fun to talk about, and I do have questions about the broader market as well, but I want to ask you one more thing. I was looking at one of your notes, and you wrote that Bitcoin slide is a necessary means to achieve digitization of financial markets, and I wanted to ask you what you meant by that, and maybe if you can focus on that Bitcoin slide part of the question.
Yeah. So we had now three quote-unquote sell-offs, and I call the slide, but a sell-off in Bitcoin. And there's all these particular reasons for why that happened. The last one, this was more specifically related to Venezuela. Just, I guess, a market reaction of people being overly excited along Bitcoin, and there's a glitch, and people get a little scared, and it sells off. But the way I look at that is to say that volatility that we're experiencing is indeed this maturing asset, right? Of it should actually be very volatile as it becomes more mature, because there's more and more people involved in that space, right? And it's no surprise that then if something like with this Venezuela event, which would have not really mattered much at all, suddenly becomes very sought out on the web, and it leads to volatility of Bitcoin, even though it didn't need to be that way. It was just, you know, a short glitch in the app, Shivo wallet, as opposed to anything with where Bitcoin was mined or traded on exchange or anything like that, right? So I think it's a function of that it becomes it's maturing, and therefore the volatility is a necessary means for us to make that further step to this completely digitalized financial markets, I find amazing that we're already making steps that way. The Central Bank of Thailand has issued a bond over blockchain, settled it. And the European Investment Bank, which is the agency in Europe that looks after infrastructure investments, is issuing bonds over blockchain. When you get those type of institutions involved, testing that out, this is going to become very quickly mainstream. Within the next year or so, we're going to have a lot of corporations doing this. Same way, all adopting that technology. But it cannot come along with more volatility as more and more people are getting involved in it, right? And that's, I think, where I'm coming from.
Yeah, Ben, I wanted to switch gears a little bit to another topic I know you've been watching closely. That was Christine Lagarde at the European Central Bank this week. I feel like she pulled a bit of a Jedi mind trick by basically announcing tapering and then saying, no, I'm not tapering, you know. But, you know, given the negative yields in Europe and the case is always made whenever the question is, well, who's buying U.S. treasuries at these yields? The argument is, well, have you seen the yields in Europe? You know, how big of a deal is the ECB sort of taking the foot off the gas a little bit with their emergency pandemic program? I mean, it doesn't seem like it's caught anyone by surprise in the markets. You know, the euro was kind of mixed against most currencies. I didn't see any sort of dramatic moves, but how are you thinking about this announcement from Lagarde this week? Is it, you know, change the calculus at all, thinking about, you know, bond markets going forward for the rest of the year?
Yeah, it could be, Mike, because I think, like, so she says, you know, the lady can't taper, right, or isn't tapering, which that reference to Margaret Thatcher's speech. But in the essence, they are, right? Whatever you call slowing down those purchases in any sort of way, it ultimately is tapering. But the market, you know, the bond market in Europe rallied on this because, you know, whatever they are slowing down the pace with, it still covers a fair bit of issuance well into next year. And that's just, I think, the reason why there was a bit of a relief.
Yeah. But almost all of Italy's issuance, right? And
yeah, fair bit of. But here's the interesting change that's going to happen. Is the ECB is very smart running two programs at the same time, right? They have this emergency program called PEP, and they have this QE program, it's called APP, and that QE program will come back in a more meaningful way as the PEP program winds down. And she talked about that extensively. But the importance for the bond market is that under that PEP program, we really are addressing the pandemic, and we're going to buy large volumes as much as we can to keep markets really, really loose in financial conditions and everything functioning well till that pandemic really is weighing off. It's the first step for the ECB to acknowledge that the pandemic is, in their mind, slowly changing, right? It is waning. And they made a point about it that they hit the 70% vaccination, which is a key metric to the ECB. So there's that change happening. Plus, they're going to make the APP, the normal QE program, a more important part of their toolkit. And the reason why that matters is because that program is designed to bring inflation back to the target and keep it to the target. And that program is really, the guidance on that is about interest rate hikes in the future once you succeed by bringing inflation back to the target. So my view on this is that, yes, we got this nice rally on this PEP, you know, okay, slowly adjusting, issuance still covered, but on the APP, the issuance of bonds is not much covered. It doesn't need to be an 80 billion program, probably much smaller, maybe 40, maybe 30 billion. So that will put pressure on yields in the future. Plus, it's really designed to bring inflation back, which the market does know. Like, once you get there, the rate hike, so to speak, will be coming into the horizon. And that's I think, what's going to play from here now. Now, why does this matter even further is that Eurozone government bonds, as you say, are negative yielding, the majority of it. So you have this negative yielding bond index that you can look up on Bloomberg. It was something like, I think, 16, 17 trillion recently, and it's fallen by about a few trillion because, yes, bond yields and French government bond yields and all those have all moved up a little bit higher. I think it's going to continue that way, which means that the deflationary expectations in those bond prices in Europe are really moving away. As the ECB is succeeding with this strategy of managing the pandemic, then bringing that old QE program back to life, again, inflation to the target. some people may be sounding like, wow, that's pretty ambitious, Ben, because that's never going to happen in Europe. But I think that they have some window here to succeed with that. So I think negative yields in Europe will somewhat disappear, not entirely, but will somewhat, even though the ECB will keep buying bonds.
I appreciate that, Ben. You know, Vildana gets bored with the ECB talk.
Yeah.
She wants to talk about stonks with an N. Stonks, right,
Vildana? Right, right. I'm not going to use that word, but I did want to bring us back to the domestic, the U.S. stock market, because something that we were looking at this week is strength in tech, in particular, the big cap tech stocks. And we found that about 50% of S&P 500 stocks are down 10% since May, and that's true of 90% of Russell 2000 stocks. So what does that tell us about tech strength and why investors might be treating big tech as safe havens right now? And is it at all tied to some of the worries that people have about COVID and the Delta variant?
It's certainly with that, but there's uncertainty about Delta variant. And that really, because of the delay of going back to office, has made the stay-at-home trade, so to speak, you know, again, you know, flaring up in value, right? And meaning it's becoming popular again, and tech plays a big role in that. But I think it's also to do with that this defensive nature of the market goes further than tech. And that's that 50-50 portfolio. I'm jumping maybe to a topic that we wanted to discuss, but this 50-50 idea that I was looking at was that you have industrial staples and, you know, this type of even utilities, and that includes tech, considerably defensive. Some of those have actually lagged tech, even though the defensive sectors. And at the same time, you have the offensive side of the market, retail, some of the reopening sectors that are still much value in there, let's say airlines as an example. And so I thought about this 50-50 portfolio of those combined and tracking that against the tech sector. And it actually, interestingly, how the 50-50 portfolio is performing better now than tech. And you can also see this from the relative value between tech and say industrials. So industrials have been really strong because of the pandemic and all the production that's needed. And all the pipeline pressures, supply chain pressures that we have. But if you take the relative ratio between tech and industrials, that's now a lot lower than it was during the major disruption phases in January or last year, when really tech was hugely outperforming. So there is strength in tech, but it's not as strong anymore, I think, if you compare it to industrials than it has been before. At the same time, the market, to your point, is defensive. Or getting more defensive, which is, I think, also now the debate in the market. You had, interestingly, B of A, who were really bearish on the market, have upgraded their year-end target, but are still bearish. You have another, Morgan Stanley, who are much more bullish and have kind of become more cautious. I think that speaks to this market, ready to have some sort of a correction again, and tech therefore plays this defensive role. I know this is an easy position to be in if you do get this drawdown, so to speak. But I would say, though, this, that as a last point, the drawdown ultimately will really happen, I think, because of the economy shifting again from what we had a bit of a Delta impact over the last number of months or weeks, becoming again more visible that that's going to wane because that wave will taper off. And then the tapering from the Fed comes into play, plus the budget resolution that is being negotiated. Is a big pressure to get that really through. So there's plenty of that fundamental reason to see a drawdown in the market, which then would make tech, I think, a bit vulnerable ultimately, right? The large caps will underperform. So tech is in demand because of defense, but I think there's come a moment that this drawdown in the markets is upon us again, as all these opinions are getting converging to one another and everybody's getting cautious.
Yeah, curious about that, Ben. I think in one note, correct me if I'm wrong, but you mentioned that one possible catalyst for a drawdown could be sort of a renewed rotation into Europe or other parts of the world. And, you know, how are you thinking about that relative value globally? I mean, if we, especially here in the U.S., you know, obviously we're we're kind of plateauing out on vaccines. We seem to have this hesitancy to vaccination that parts of Europe and the rest of the world don't quite have. At the same time, it doesn't look like this $3.5 trillion budget plan from Biden is going to pass without some cuts to it. We've got that dreaded debt ceiling approaching again, and the famous extraordinary measures and all that. Is it a time to start looking outside of the U.S. and start looking overseas, do you think?
You could use it as an argument, Mike, because if we had some relative underperformance of Asian markets to the U.S. because Asia was the first region to come out of the pandemic without much pain, but it was also the region where the vaccinations were really slow in the first phase. Now they're picking up really rapidly, right? And that's not just in Singapore, it's happening also in even markets like Hong Kong, where there was huge hesitancy about vaccinations. And Japan now too has picked up really quickly. So Asia is getting, in that respect, a bit in a better position. If you think about this rotation trade, which is really a momentum trade, right? That has been playing the entire pandemic. Each time one area underperforms another area and there's progress made in the pandemic in one way or the other, right? Whether the lockdowns end or vaccinations increase, the money flows to that relative underperforming area. In this case now, it's Asia Pacific area. Think of Singapore, think of Hong Kong, think of New Zealand, think of Japan. And yeah, if you look at a graph where you normalize those ETFs versus the SPY ETF, that is a gap, right? And I think it will not entirely close that gap, but it will definitely be a catch-up here, really playing on again, this reopening cyclical momentum idea that we've been into since, say, April of last year, when we, come out of the depth of the of the worst of the pandemic. Europe, on the other hand, is now a little bit in a phase of that. Yes, the ECB is, in my view, tapering. The lady can taper, right? So it is happening. and you can kind of tell, right? It starts to like way on the markets there. They're down more month to date so far since all that hawkish language came out. And now today we get the news than US markets or Asian markets. So I do think that the Europe probably, despite its success with vaccination rates, will deal now with more the policy changing to a degree. So that's an interesting aspect of the global macro landscape too, right? Because if you look at Asia Pacific, New Zealand and Korea, for example, they booked success against the virus and they now see their bond yields normalized towards 2% on the 10-year. So it does show that when you get that virus better under control, that interest rates can depart from the virus influence on the pandemic, right? That's an important observation. And the second one is Europe, that you made a huge progress with all this vaccination. You're getting the situation there also better under control. Now you can focus on adjusting policy, and that will affect markets negatively in equities there, right? So I think if we look at both examples, I think the opportunities in Asia Pacific equities, they have lagged the US, and there's progress in the pandemic there, but that also means yields normalizing. So there is that risk on trade. Whereas in Europe is a bit of the opposite way. You get a bit of traction on equities. We are in the US not at that in that situation just yet, right? The yields and treasuries are kind of range bound and boxed in, and so is the S&P. So I do think we're going to go to that scenario. I would expect us that we will get to a point where yields are going to be reflecting more of a normal economy that is not so much anymore in the influence of the pandemic as tapering then gets on the way.
Tighten up your straitjackets. It's time for the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Now, Valdana, as you know, Ben is no stranger to this podcast. It's not his first time at the rodeo. So I know he came prepared with a crazy thing for us, Ben. Let's have it. What's the craziest thing you saw in markets this week?
So, a bit from history too, that I know I had once Twitter account a while back and it got hacked and all kinds of funky stuff happened. So, but these days I'm a little bit on there again. I watch all the celebrities on there and I see Valdana tweeting and Bloomberg tweeting. And then all of a sudden one evening I see this tweet coming out of a guy laying with two hairy legs on the beach. But the interesting thing is that those legs were just, the lower legs were actually looked like shaved, but the rest of it was pretty hairy. It turned out to be you. And I thought, like, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen.
Were you at the Jersey Shore?
That was me at the beach. That was me at the Jersey Shore, yes. Yes. I do not shave the upper parts of the legs. That's just my natural receding hairline, I guess, of the legs.
That's why you should stay off Twitter, Ben. Yeah. That's reason enough. That's
right. Stay away.
I was hacked too, Ben.
Yeah, oh, you did? Okay.
No, I wasn't. Those are my legs. I'm proud of those legs. All right, Fultana, that's a good one. I don't know. Can you beat my hairy legs?
Well, I was just going to go with something that happened to me, which is I was reporting on Bitcoin earlier this week, and I was in the midst of talking to somebody about why Bitcoin could potentially hit 51,000 and then go above that this week. We were just looking at some technical signals, and while we were talking, it started dropping. And that's my weirdest thing for this week. It's just the speed with which Bitcoin fell. I think it was on Tuesday morning, New York time, it went from down 10%, down 12, down 50. I looked up, I have this little screen on my Bloomberg terminal. It was down 17%. And I literally couldn't believe it. We were just talking about it potentially going higher, and just the speed with which it fell. It was something.
That's when you quickly say, well, where's the support then? If that
ever is, right. Yeah. And then I was chatting.
Change the topic.
I was chatting with people. I was like, what just happened? And everybody was like, I have no idea, but this is normal for Bitcoin.
Well, to your point, yeah, it looked more like a Saturday night special for Bitcoin than, right. What you see at the opening of the week. That's a good one, Vildana. I'm going to give you mine. Mine's courtesy of a story in CoinDesk via the Matt Levine Excellent Money Stuff newsletter. Now, it kind of feels like cheating to talk about NFTs and the crazy things because the whole concept is crazy, in my opinion. But this one is especially crazy because, okay, there was, and it combines the other craziest thing of our lifetime, which is Dogecoin. So the image of the original Shiba Inu dog that Dogecoin is based on. It's a meme. Hopefully people know what I'm talking about. But it was a meme with a dog, and that's what Dogecoin was created around. That was turned into an NFT, that image. It sold for about $4 million a few months ago, 3 months ago. Now, here's where it gets crazy. So whoever bought it decided, okay, I'm going to carve this up and offer fractional shares of this NFT. 17 billion tokens were created by cutting up this NFT. 20% of them sold to one buyer, and it's time to play Prices Right. All right, Ben. If I were to buy a $4 million NFT, what would you expect someone to pay for 20% of that $4 million NFT?
Yeah, well, that would be $800,000. Is that right? It would be $800,000.
$800,000. Right? Yeah, that's good. Quick math there. I put you on the spot there, but yeah.
Yeah, but it you know, the 20% of 4 million is not 800,000, right? It maybe be more 2 million, right? Like, as in 20% can be doubled easily, simply because it's such a unique artifact that you own on that blockchain. No one else can until that changes. So in other words, it's not transaction. There's no commoditized market here. That's for sure.
Yep. You're in the right direction. 45 million for 20% of an NFT that originally sold a few months ago for 4 million. So I guess the idea is that you break this thing up. I don't know. I'm trying to guess what the idea is for any of this is crazy. But I guess that notion of fractionalizing it and breaking it up, you know, I don't know. I can't wrap my head around this. As Levine said, it's all a big joke. And, you know, the original joke was it's selling for 4 million. And then it's an even better joke that 20% of it sells for 45 million. But,
well, the topic that we didn't talk about that you wanted to talk about was why Bill Gross had suddenly an interest in these NFTs.
Tell me about that. Now, listeners don't know, Ben used to work at PIMCO back in the Bill Gross era. He was it was a credit fund you managed, right?
A global funds, yeah, but also involved in his fund, Total Return.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, Bill's history is also with artifacts, is his post-stamp collection, right? They had a huge collection, a very unique poster. So again, same idea. He was the only one owning that. And unless he sold them, which he did, but he sold a part of it for charity. I think that's why he was interested in the NFT concept. But the interesting thing I found from his op-ed was that he, you know, he was complaining a lot about, okay, we're now really too low with interest rates. I already told you 10 years ago that rates were too low, or even lower, and gosh, we're going to do here. Don't sit in bond funds. You know, think about NFTs. And I almost wanted to say, like, well, that's your diversification, right? If you think about, if you're worried about inflation, if you worry about low interest rates or real interest rates being so negative, then an NFT probably is another sort of form of a hedge against your dislocated bond market, so to speak. Because if bonds have a risk reward that's so asymmetric, you have more downside than upside in the current situation, even much worse than when he ranted about it 10 years ago, when he also said that it was a really poor time for treasuries, then an NFT could make a difference. And the returns in NFTs are so gigantic, right, that would compensate you so much for any kind of inflation shock. That was sort of, I think, where he was coming from. But, you know, at the end of the day, a mutual fund, a 40 Act mutual fund, so to speak, you know, is unlikely to purchase NFTs.
They're not going to be calling him the NFT king anytime soon, I suppose.
Not likely, you know. But post, even though he, you know, during the time that he managed that fund, yeah, he was an advent post-stamp collector, right? And he was very known in that world, which is, you know, completely outside of the financial markets world, right? So yeah. like NFTs.
That's a good comparison because, you know, what is the intrinsic value of that little piece of paper that a stamp's printed on, you know, nothing. And,
no,
you
know, but
it's the value is what someone's willing to pay for it. So I it kind of makes sense to think of NFTs in that perspective, I guess.
Yeah, collector's item, you know, and people want to hold it and it's therefore an emotional value, I guess, but it's a collector's item. So no one else has it but you. You just really have this really unique artifact. Then therefore it's worth a lot more intrinsically than what the physical value of it is. Right?
But Vildana, should I make an NFT of my dog? Do you think anyone would buy that?
You should try it, definitely.
Might as well try.
Yeah, why not? This is the time, yeah.
And speaking of the time, I think that is all the time we have for today. Ben Emmons, always a pleasure to catch up with you. Been on the podcast many times. Listeners, if you want to hear Ben's takes on other things, you got to scroll through a few months' worth of episodes. But he's been on a few times, and we always appreciate his time. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for that. It was great to be here. Great discussion.
Thanks, Ben.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heirich is at Vildana Heirich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellet of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Laura Carlson. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.